introduce to you Dr. Evelyn Lewis.
Good morning. I want to thank her for that introduction, but because of the fire alarm that we had a few minutes ago and the need now to sort of cut the time, I told her she could just say, here's that one. And she said she'd never use that phrase. I was like, why not? Look who that one is. So again, I say thank you for this opportunity to speak with you this morning. And while I do, within the slides that I wanted to show and share with you, have some information that's sort of hot off the press. I didn't anticipate it would set off the alarm. But nonetheless, we will move ahead here, and there will be some that I'll skip over so that I can ensure to keep Dr. Ruffin in his relaxed mode so that he doesn't feel like we're going to go over too much. In any event, starting off, what I want to just sort of share with you this morning is really what Pfizer does, who we are in respect to this summit and what it stands for and what it means. And as you can see from the first slide here, I'm starting off with what the commitment of the company is around this issue. And it speaks to our commitment to taking action against health and healthcare disparities, because those with the tools, the talent, and resources and the will to build these bridges that we've been talking about throughout these past few days have a most urgent need to do so. And we must all remember that, because the need is indeed urgent. I'm sure that you all have felt that same sort of compelling need to get going and to do the kinds of things that we need to do so that we can get this work advanced as quickly as possible. When we look at some of those commitments in terms of the company, you can see the kinds of things that we look to do, and that is to be number one in terms of the production of the best medicines, making them available to people who need them, delivering sort of the best life-saving modalities, also around the different medications that we develop, and giving and contributing to the poor, those who cannot afford those medications at the prices that they sell for, but ensuring that they too have access to those therapies, and being sort of the number one in terms of the philanthropy of companies that are providing that. We also look at, again, while discovering and developing these medical innovations, in the way of advancing the promise of health, we recognize that the innovations that remain inaccessible to all, that the need for them promises that remain unkept. Essentially means to us that if we have the ability to do something, then we need to do it, and we need to do it now with that sense of urgency that I mentioned earlier. So as we talk about providing solutions, this was sort of an overall view that the Institute of Medicine report gave us several years ago. They offered a number of interventions and solutions around this whole healthcare disparities issue. Many of us know that as sort of the Bible, if you will, directive on this issue of healthcare disparities. And they mentioned a number of things, as you can see here. They talked about increasing awareness, health system interventions, data collection and monitoring, and patient and provider education. And throughout the course of this summit, much of that has been talked about in the number of different presentations that we've all had. Then we look at what companies like a Pfizer or other corporate entities can do as it relates to this issue of healthcare disparities. And we look at things like collecting and distributing data, if you will, about their employees as it relates to the issues that we're talking about, development and implementation of prevention programs. You'll hear me talk a little bit more about prevention later, because that has not necessarily been the focus of what we call our healthcare system. Also improving adherence to therapies and implementation of cultural competency training. And we've had numerous presentations and sessions on that issue alone. So as we've talked about what the Institute of Medicine put out as some of the interventions that could possibly be done, what some companies at this level should be doing, now I'm going to focus a little bit more on exactly what it is that Pfizer has done, is doing, and sort of looks ahead to do. When we talk about collecting and distributing data, Pfizer has a series of publications called Pfizer Facts. We have worked with the National Medical Association, the Hispanic Medical Association, in terms of publishing these as we talk about these issues in their relationship to minority populations. We also looked at partnering with others to deliver prevention programs. And again, that key word there is prevention, because our healthcare system, or you'll see in another slide where it's clearly referred to as a sick care system, does not necessarily promote wellness and prevention. And so we look at how we partner with communities, employers, schools, et cetera, to carry that message and move that message forward. Also looking at promoting physician and patient relationships. One of the sessions I was in yesterday talked in depth about that particular role there. And a lot of the cultural competency or cultural proficiency issues that we talk about play prominently in that particular section. Providing access to medicines. Again, you've heard me say how Pfizer has a number of different programs that are focused primarily on doing that, and we'll see some more of those too as we move along here. Collecting and distributing data. Again, the Pfizer facts that I talked about earlier, these are just a sampling of some of them. The one on cancer was, again, a partnership with one of the NMA members. And then we did racial and differences in cardiovascular diseases. And we've had a couple of new ones that are will be coming off of the press here in the next few weeks that should be available for you all to also see. Partnering with others to deliver prevention programs, again, talking about communities, employers, et cetera. These are just a sampling of some of the programs that we are partners with. One is the Church of God in Christ. They had a huge sort of awareness program looking at the Community Health Initiative. As you can see, that's a large organization. It's about 6 million members. About 2 million of those are in a position of need, if you will, as it relates to the ability to get their medications, et cetera. And this organization is such that it has its own pharmacy, it has its own programs in terms of how they set them up such that these people are very much able to get the products that they need. Southern Ain't Fried Sundays. This was a program in partnership with the state of Arkansas, and it looked at the inequities in health, in particular as it related to obesity, in several counties in that state. And we partnered with them to get information out, to do all kinds of prevention programs, screening programs, et cetera. The result was this book that was published in terms of a cookbook that showed alternative ways of preparing these meals. And it also, the results of this, which we had a whole other slide presentation on that, talked about the weight loss that resulted in the programmatic rollout of this program in that state. Another one was Florida, a healthy state. It was a program that was run primarily through what's called Pfizer Health Solutions, which is a little bit of an independent part of the company that focuses on partnerships with states, state governments, et cetera. And this was a really exciting program here because, as you can see from this slide, the anticipated enrollment was about 50,000 or so patients. But you can see as we went through the final year there where it ended up. This was such a successful program in terms of getting people enrolled, getting them healthier, and saving the state of Florida money until they put out a competitive grant that the Pfizer Health Solutions again competed for and was awarded to continue this type of work. The Southern HIV/AIDS Prevention Initiative, this was primarily the partnership through the Pfizer Foundation. And again, it was about 9 states in the southern U.S., where the focus was on HIV education and awareness in terms of connecting the different smaller HIV programs in different locations, connecting them with each other such that they can broaden their reach in respect to their messages. And that's been a very successful program. We've had some of the key leaders from those different states, in particular the leaders in the program in South Carolina, join us at the Congressional Black Caucus to speak on this very program for the past 3 years. Promoting physician-patient relationships, looking at improving cultural sensitivity and the doctor-patient relationship. And again, as we talk about that relationship, obviously a lot of it is based on communication, whether the patient is having difficulty understanding what that provider is talking about in terms of his illness, or just difficulty in interpreting what the results of a test or what have you mean. Health literacy, as we all know, is a major contributor to the problem that we talked about most of the time that we spent here. And so Pfizer, through the work of Dr. Barbara DeBono, did a huge rollout and development of a program around health literacy. And it's had its own conference, actually, in D.C. for about the past 5 or 6 years. Again, Clear Health Communications, which incorporates that health literacy program, but also is sort of a link to a number of different people who work with that particular subject matter and looking at how we connect the people that it will best influence and help. The other things that you see there are also some other programs that focus primarily on the Hispanic and Latino communities in terms of increasing their awareness of their diseases through publications in their respective languages. Providing access to medicines, again, to low income or those who are unable to purchase them or to the uninsured. And there are a number of different programs that we have. One in particular, Helpful Answers, you see a little bit there on the side. There's the Hospital Partnership Program. And Helpful Answers, I wanted to get to this slide in particular because any of the programs that come under that, which you see listed here, the Share the Care, the hospital program, the program that gets medications to the federally qualified health centers, all of those have been made available through Pfizer Helpful Answers. And I look at that program sort of as the Walmart of programs to help people find access. Because if you call that 1-800 number, if you don't qualify for this program or that program, what they do is they help you find the program that you do qualify for. So it eliminates a lot of the work that patients have had to do that becomes very frustrating for them, and in essence, then they just drop out of the system and don't do it. Going forward, health reform, you all have a copy of Pfizer's health reform principles that the company has worked on over the past year. We know that that's a huge topic that's up and coming, is the reform of our healthcare system or our sick care system, depending on how you look at it. You'll see those principles. I'm going to have a slide that talks about them, but I won't go through each and every one of them. Have you read that on your own, and feel free to provide comment to us regarding those. Talk a little bit about sort of that hot off the press news around a concept that we have called the Center of Excellence for Healthcare Disparity Solutions and sort of investing in disease prevention. Again, those principles that I mentioned, the guiding principle for setting all of that into motion was that all Americans, regardless of health status or income, should have affordable access to health coverage and culturally relevant quality health care. The goal must be to eliminate disparities in health and health care access and quality. So that was the basis for the reform principles that you have a copy of. And again, as we look at this piece around healthcare reform, you can see the words that I highlighted there, again referring to sick care versus healthcare, looking at preserving patient choice and physician autonomy, quality and efficiency of care, which are sort of key to that whole reform issue. These are the principles. Again, I told you have those in your bags. And the last thing I wanted to just talk to you a little bit about was this sort of Center of Excellence. You all are very familiar with that term, in particular because of Dr. Ruffin and his center. But we're looking at what that might look like to have one embedded within the company. And what would that do? What would it look like? The goal, we think, would be to directly impact health and healthcare disparities by targeting emerging majority and other diverse populations. Why develop this? Looking to partner and earn the trust of other scientists, regulators, physicians, and payers. And then looking at opportunities to also address other kinds of health, public health issues, such as restricted access, which we've talked a little bit about, affordability issues, lack of appropriate cultural sensitivity, and diversity in clinical trials. What would it look like? It could be somewhat of a strategic catalyst designed to align partnerships within the public and private sector to include primary stakeholders who are the usual list of culprits, if you will, clinicians, patient groups, industry, academia, government, etc. to sort of effectively and visibly eliminate the problems of healthcare disparities. And then some of the building blocks of this center briefly would be the involvement of community, policy and science and economics, research and business growth. These building blocks, I think, are very sound, and we look for obvious comment around these issues also. But if we were to use these as the building blocks, again, much of this is what's been discussed in this meeting, some of which we'll be taking back and looking at how we integrate it to further build on this concept. But again, looking at how we can put this in place in a company such as Pfizer to have it be as productive as possible. These following slides here go through the importance of diversity in clinical trials. I don't necessarily think that I need to speak to each of these. I'll go through this slide and then skip through the rest. Why is this important to Pfizer? Why do we think it's important? Because of the innovation, the engagement of the community, the leadership that a company such as Pfizer must present, and then the competitive advantage, obviously, that it will give in terms of the medications that are developed and those that it can help. If we don't have the diversity that's needed in those clinical trials, then we will have no idea about what that does in certain populations after the fact. So I'm going to end with this, which is sort of what I started with in terms of Pfizer's commitment. Most of us have heard the quote by Martin Luther King that talked about, of all the forms of inequality, injustice in health is the most shocking and the most inhumane. And I took the portion from Pfizer's commitment to taking action against health and healthcare disparities because those with the tools, the talent, and resources, and the will to build the bridges, we need to have a most urgent duty to do so. So if we're looking at this concept of public-private partnerships, we're looking at how we do more than just provide financial resources to this issue. How do we look at our scientists working together, our sales force, all within the company, looking at how we contribute to eliminating healthcare disparities throughout the company, getting everyone there engaged, and partnering with again, entities such as NIH, our community organizations, and what have you. So I thank you again very much for this opportunity to speak with you, and we look forward to continuing this partnership and getting the work of eliminating disparities done.
Okay, before I move on to our next panel, I want to do a few quick little housekeeping items. First thing I want to do is to remind you that we did commission a supplemental issue of the American Journal of Public Health, which will actually bear the name of the title of the summit, which is the science of eliminating health disparities. So keep your eye out for that. We also plan to try and have the slides and the presentations posted on our website. And another little item that I must remind you of is that for those of you that pre-registered for the conference, an evaluation form, an electronic evaluation form, was mailed to you on Monday at noon. For those that register on site, it should probably be mailed to you today, if not last night. You know, we're going green, so we want you to go in and take a look at that evaluation form and give us some feedback. One other thing I need to remind you of is for those of you who did take the shuttle bus to the Gaylord, there will be a pickup at 1 p.m., so you don't want to miss that. I think it would be a pretty long walk. But at any rate, I just want to leave those few housekeeping things to you. And now I'd like to introduce the moderator to our next panel, which is on media and policy. Our moderator will be George Strait, and George is the communication director at the National Center on Minority Health and Health Disparities. George came to NIH after more than 20 years in communications and news reporting. And for 10 years, he was a healthcare correspondent for ABC News, where he paid special attention to health, to stories on health disparities. So as a joke, I said, George, what do you want me to say about you tomorrow? He said, well, you can tell them that I'm the husband of Lisa and the grandfather of Nico. So I give you the husband of Lisa and the grandfather of Nico.
Thank you, Joyce. If the panel members could make their way up. While they're doing that, I want to thank you all for being here and looking out over this crowd. It's been a long time coming. I think that was Sam Cooke singing that on the first day, and it's truly wonderful to see you all here. I can remember in my former life at ABC News that when I approached one of my editors to do some stories about health disparity research, he said, come back when some of that research is done in white institutions. So we have come an awful long way. Now we have this wonderful composition in the Maya Angelou sense with all of the instruments playing loud and effectively together. But before we get to the heart of the panel, while the panel is sitting down, I want to illustrate the context for a lot of this discussion by showing an excerpt from a highly acclaimed film, Unnatural Causes, Is Inequality Making Us Sick? As many great films can do, it encapsulates the work reported here over the last week and points to the challenges that are still before us. If you could show the film, please.
Said that the bigwigs from corporation were there and they were going to have a powwow with us or something. Everybody wondered what they were going to talk about.
You could hear a pin drop in the crowd and people were gasping. It was a funny feeling, just kind of like you were up on a ride that drops down real fast, makes your stomach feel queasy. That's how I felt.
It was once the largest refrigerator manufacturer in the entire world, now moved away. And what sets is an enormous building that covers the acreage of a small farm. And it's so empty that if a family of rats wanted to move from one end of the building to the other, they'd have to pack their own peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
They called the bargaining committee in and they told us that they were closing the plant. So when I walked on around the floor, everybody's looking at your face, you know.
In the winter of 2006, the Electrolux Corporation closed its refrigerator manufacturing plant in Greenville, Michigan, and moved it to Juarez, Mexico. The Greenville workers earned $15 an hour with about $5 an hour in health and pension benefits. The Mexican workers made $1.57 an hour, plus bus fare and lunch.
Electrolux's decision to move the plant from Greenville to Mexico is basically just a result of them facing a very competitive environment. It is a disaster for many people when they're being laid off, but our view is more to look at the company. And unfortunately, you can say that sometimes the stock market creates the pressure on the companies to act in that respect.
In a global economy, corporations move capital at breathtaking speed to maximize profit for shareholders. Electrolux is a multinational corporation based in Sweden. The company has also moved plants from Western to Eastern Europe in pursuit of the cheapest labor. Moving the Greenville plant to Mexico will add $81 million a year to the corporate bottom line.
That's just a taste of what is really a truly remarkable film that's 4 hours in length. Perhaps you've seen it on PBS, but like everything on PBS, it will be shown again and again and again. And also at the NIH, the National Library of Medicine, is beginning a project to not only show the film there and online, but also to have sort of a virtual town hall to discuss some of the issues in the film. But on to our panel today. As you know, the theme of this summit is the integration of science, practice, and policy and the elimination of health disparities. And the goal of this panel is to explore some of the important policy questions that are before us, how best to implement those policies, and to begin to clarify the role of media in achieving some of those policy goals. Like all of the panels, we hope that this one will also begin to develop a research agenda for healthcare disparities. And our panel really is uniquely qualified to take a look at this and to guide us. You know them all. All of their bios are in the program book. To my far right is Dr. David Satcher. Again, we know him well. He's one of the most important and effective voices in public health over the last 20 years. Next to him is Dr. Claudia Baquet, who has brought the academy to the community and an amazingly effective change in both state and federal policy. Dr. Brian Smedley, who is a true composer in the Maya Angelou tradition. Next to Brian is Dr. Tim Johnson, the nation's calm and expert television voice on medical matters and my former partner in crime at ABC News. Mr. Raj Shah, who has shown us all how private industry can and must be intimate partners in eliminating health disparities. Next to Raj is Dr. Elmer Huerta, even though Elmer is the first ever Hispanic president of the American Cancer Society and perhaps the most trusted medical voice in Spanish-speaking television and radio, Elmer also still sees patients every day at his cancer clinic in Washington, D.C. And Dr. Hilton Hudson, a true Renaissance man, a noted scientific researcher, physician, publisher, and expert in developing effective media messages to health disparity populations. Now, we've set a number of records here at the summit, including probably a record number of PowerPoint slides shown at any one gathering. This panel will be a bit different. We will discuss and debate instead of show and tell. And David, perhaps you could start by helping us define what are some of the important policy questions that are before us as we try to eliminate health disparities.
Well, thank you. Before I get to those important policy questions, I just wanted to make one comment from my own sort of life experience in terms of media and policy. I grew up in the South, in Alabama, and I was a teenager when the civil rights movement sort of started, so I sort of witnessed close up what happened in Alabama and then throughout the country, later being a part of the student sit-in movement. And observing that, and especially observing Martin Luther King Jr., and we used to walk from the Morehouse campus to his church whenever we knew that he was going to be in town. And when I think about the role of leadership, I think about the role of educating, motivating, and mobilizing individuals and communities toward a goal, and in this case, changing policies. And I think one of the things that Martin Luther King Jr. demonstrated was that if you are the minority, if you're the underdog, and you have a case, the best ally that you can have is the media. When Martin Luther King took the movement to Birmingham, which was just 60 miles from my home, and Bull Connor and the Dogs, his strategy was only clear later, and that was to show America the face of racism in the South, something that we were living with every day. So I have come to value the media even before I became Surgeon General. And I used to say, suppose there were a Surgeon General's report and no media came, nothing would happen. So we depend upon the media. So I want to make that point. There are some very critical policy issues that impact the elimination of disparities in health, or that goal. And if you don't believe that, just think about the fact that since 2000, when we released Healthy People 2010, at that time there were 39 million Americans who were uninsured. And today there are about 47 million. So we've added 8 million Americans to the uninsured. So access has really declined since the year 2000 because of policies and because we failed to implement health reform. So I think the overriding policy challenge that we face as it relates to the elimination of disparities in health, is in fact moving toward reforming our health system so that it becomes a balanced community health system, balanced in the sense that it balances health promotion, disease prevention, early detection, and universal access to care. I think that's the challenge that we face. And if we can get there over the next 4 to 8 years, then I think it would be the greatest contribution to eliminating disparities in health. I want to make it very clear that I don't mean to imply that this is just about health care, and that's why I said balanced community health system, because a balanced community health system will, in fact, invest in the social determinants of health. Education, early child development being very prominent in terms of social determinants of health. But I think if we, you know, health care, however, is itself a social determinant of health. And there's no place that illustrates that better than the United States, because over the last 10 years, especially before the economic downturn, the major cause of bankruptcy in this country were people getting sick who could not afford their health care. And every day, of course, families suffer because of a critical illness and the impact that it has on the finances. So in many ways, the lack of access to health care is a major social determinant of health. So I think that's a major policy issue that we must all work toward. Obviously, I've been concerned with childhood obesity, and I just want to close by saying that when it comes to childhood obesity, there are policy changes needed on the local level, the state level, the federal level, and the global level. Sanjay Gupta last week had on his program the story of a principal who had decided several years ago that her school was going to be, quote, sugar-free, that the students were going to have model good nutrition, physical education K-12. She changed policies in that school. School districts across the country are now being challenged to develop wellness policies. At the state level, of course, states are making decisions about trans fats and things like physical education, whether it's going to be required throughout the state. At the federal level, when Congress passed the wellness policy in 2004, it was probably the major thing that's happened since the Surgeon General's report on overweight and obesity, which we released in 2001, requiring all schools to develop wellness policies in order to qualify for free breakfast, free lunch programs. So on and on, of course, obviously the best example of a global policy, and one of the few, of course, is the World Tobacco Treaty that the World Health Assembly passed in 2003. So these are all really critical policy issues that affect disparities in health and the whole quest for global health equity.
Dr. McKay, a balanced system, break it down, as the kids would say, break it down for us.
A balanced system, to piggyback on Dr. Satcher's comments, is a greater and immediate emphasis on prevention and wellness, as well as the recognition that our need for health reform goes well beyond providing insurance to individuals and their family. And that includes something else that Dr. Satcher referred to, the investment in education for our children and our families, as one of the major ways to focus on not only reforming health, but eliminating disparities. So I do believe that we have an unprecedented opportunity now. I know that you have expressed an interest in what are the roots for sound policy related to elimination of health disparities. And certainly, at no other time in history have we had a citizen or public mandate to make change, including to make the quality of life, which includes health, social welfare, as well as education, as an integral part of any reform package. So well beyond insurance.
Dr. Smedley, there's some policy implications involving changing the language. A lot of what we've heard this week talks about changing the language when we talk about health disparities, health care, health promotion, and even prevention. What does prevention mean anymore? Talk about some of those implications.
Sure. Our language is so important around these issues. Many folks at this conference have talked about the need to move from talking about disparities, which is more of a numerical concept, the fact that people of color have poorer health status than the majority population, to talking about inequality. And I believe that when we make that shift, we're making a very, very important statement to policymakers. So I believe that there's no more important scientific and policy question than the question of how do we manage inequality in our society. Inequality, we now know, has huge consequences for population health broadly. Doesn't just hurt those folks who are at the bottom tiers of the wealth and income ladder. Inequality has important health consequences for all of us. So I think the challenge is to figure out how do we manage this growing inequality, a problem that has been growing much more rapidly since about 1980. We are now one of the most unequal societies in the world in terms of wealth and income. It's playing out today, obviously, in terms of the economic downturn. Folks who have already been at the margins are going to be at risk for even further declines in health status. So this is obviously something that is a key pressing issue. I believe that part of our challenge moving into this new era is to figure out how do we best conduct research and translate that to policy immediately so that we can address the consequences of gross inequality in this country.
This really is a discussion, so if you feel the need, you've got to jump in. That's fine. No one here is shy. Tim, is David right that if it doesn't appear on ABC News, it never happened?
Well, there are some other networks where it might appear. but I certainly agree with that, and with the major point David was making, which is that we've got to look at the overall issue of health policy and not just focus on bits and pieces of it, whether it be minority issues or many other issues. And so I'll speak to that in two ways. One, to tell you a little bit about what we're doing at ABC, and I hope is happening at other places. We have a task force on health care reform that is working very hard right now. More importantly, I have convinced the president of ABC News, David Weston, and even more importantly, two of the major anchors, Diane Sawyer and Charlie Gibson, to get on board with this issue. They're very enthused about it. And I've met with the staff in New York. I'm meeting with the staff in Washington today. So we are building some momentum inside of our organization to talk about healthcare reform in all of its ramifications and to do a lot of programming. Even more important, here's where I'm an eternal optimist. I personally feel, and we can all talk about this, that the stars are lining up a little bit. I had breakfast this morning with Ron Pollack, Families USA. They are holding an all-day conference bringing together 20 disparate organizations, including insurance and pharma. We know tremendous activity in Congress right now. Peter Orszag going to the Office of Budget and Management, I think, is a great move because he's passionate about health care. And finally, Tom Daschle being Secretary of HHS. Anybody who hasn't should read his new book because it's really spectacular, and it talks a lot about issues of minority and inequality. So I think something's going to happen in 2009.
Raj, explain how private industry sort of works in here, and as I said before, it really needs to be an intimate partner in developing new policies toward the elimination of the health disparities.
And let me just make two comments just to support before I address that. First of all, I'm also very optimistic. I think the change is happening. And fundamentally, one of our slogans is, yes, I can take care of my health. I'm picking up on President-elect Obama. But it's very, very important to realize that technology plays a very role in how we have to reach the disparity people. And Dr. Satcher, I agree that the insurance issue is about 47 million. But probably our estimate shows about 60 million. There are a lot of people who have insurance, but it's really not complete. Mm-hmm. And the geography and the location. And so it's very, very difficult to reach. And even if you have insurance, mm-hmm. chronic disease in some of the major, major areas are very difficult to get all the right doctors to take care of you. Now, in terms of reaching, and this is where it's very important, you have to go where the health disparity population is. And of course, it's not just minority and underserved. It is rural areas. It's and that means we've looked at models that uses community ministry of churches. We've used as mobile med. We've used primary care coalition types of organization. I'm looking at use of technology at, you know, whether it's gas station, whether it's grocery store, whether it's other places where awareness and outreach can take place. Go where they do things. Elmer's going to talk about it. It's cultural. It's social. It's age appropriate. You know, you have to, whether it's music, whether it is, you know, the things that they do in the community, health should be explained in such a way that it is an economic problem. When you're healthy, you're going to do well, you're going to go to school, you're going to get education, and I think it makes a fundamental difference. So use of internet, use of media, I even think that in our local papers, it would be nice to see every once in a while supplements that only talks about health as an addition, and have the private sector really get involved in funding that and promoting that rather than just having the advertisement. I was happy to see Pfizer. I've been working with them. But there are a number of other. I've worked with Inova in this area and MedStar, which is where Elmer is. So there is a commitment, but what we need to do is build a network that's independent of network that is a standard network. This is a public-private partnership, but it needs to start at the grassroots. And reaching them, but not just reaching them through the human interfaces and social interfaces, but through the use of technology. And that is something we want to talk about.
You raised two issues there. One, the communication of this, but also does private industry need an incentive? Does it need to be policies that incentivize private industry to do these kinds of things? Because, let's be frank about this. Are they just going to do it on their own?
I think they ought to do it on their own, but we could do incentives. Let's talk about clinical trials. Minority accrual is so significant requirement, and it is lacking dramatically. And if they want to sell drugs to the minority industry, they're going to have to make sure that they're included. So it's an investment to me. It doesn't have to be that the government has to provide incentives. I think they can participate themselves, and we've been building that kind of a network. But on the other hand, government can and will participate. But the issue really comes down to it is, why is it not a business opportunity? Because you're selling drugs, and you need this population also to take care of. You think about HIV/AIDS, and all the drugs that we made, when we took it to Africa, a lot of them didn't work. And then we have to retool it. So the issue comes down to it is, let the private industry recognize not just this is a care and compassion issue, but really it is an investment, and it is something that's going to make them a better economic and give them a return on investment.
Elmer?
Well, it seems to me that the role of the media needs to be to empower people by information saturation. What I mean by this is that health information needs to be on a daily basis, exactly like sports, like weather. I ask often to people when I give my talks if they conceive their 11 o'clock news without a sports guy. It would be impossible to see it. And 11 o'clock news without the sports guy or the weather guy. But you know what? Health is not every day. And it is there. It's just a little note that doesn't give any context, any perspective. So I think consistency, meaning every single day. Number two, having comments on every theme, not being only periodical in the delivery of health information. In other words, those campaigns, prostate cancer week. For a week, you saturate the community with it, and then nothing happens until next year. Breast cancer awareness month. 1 month, you are saturated, then nothing happens. No, I think we need to get rid of that mindset and just provide the health information to the public on a daily basis, but with all sorts of things. And number three, I would say that it is extremely important for NIH to realize that we need to be multimedia. We need to be to use all kinds of media. So every day, everything, and every media needs to be used to deliver the information in order to translate this complicated science language for people to empower them so they can act upon that kind of information.
Dr. Hudson, that's a lot of the work that you do.
Yes, it is. You know, I think that it's important for the media not only to show this consistently, I totally agree with you, but show examples of true empowerment, true successes. I think that, you know, as I go around the country, I still do heart surgery, and for the most part, people are afraid to get treated. No matter how educated they are, no matter what their access is, what their economic status is, they are afraid to go to doctors. And I think that if we can somehow empower patients using culturally appropriate and sensitive health messages, being consistent with it, it will empower folks and will allow people to make a difference in their lives.
So it's not just men that don't go to the doctor?
It's not just men. It's right. It's unfortunately, you know, more men, obviously, than women don't, but educated people don't as well.
But it seems like what we're talking about here, though, in the use of the media is using the traditional media. And I wonder if there's an opportunity to reach folks in different ways and to affect policy change in ways we haven't done before by using media that is not so filtered. If you pitch a story to Tim, Tim becomes a filter for your message. Are there with the internet and with texting and all the rest, do we have other ways to do that? What's been the experience? And anyway, Brian, Claudia?
I think that Dr. Huerta has it right, that we need to use multiple sources of media. The president-elect has been brilliant in communicating directly with his constituency through social networking tools, Facebook, YouTube, that kind of thing. I think we need to do that. But I think we need to think more broadly about the role of the media as well. We've focused on strategies to help people improve their individual awareness of health behavior, health promotion. That's all very important. But we also have an opportunity to use various forms of media, including new media, to help empower communities and to help communities to be more effective in addressing their problems. Helping communities to organize, particularly through the internet, I think is one of the most promising strategies, and government ought to help facilitate that, as I think our president-elect is doing.
I completely agree. And one format that we're having some preliminary success with that's gaining attention across the country is putting health information kiosks in community settings. So there's information on elimination of disparities or access or risk assessments, and then how you can reduce your risk for chronic illnesses immediately available in, of course, the print and broadcast media. But in your community pharmacy, you can go up and push a button. In the waiting area of a federally qualified health center, community health center, you can go up to the kiosk. There are large print for the seniors and folks who wear certain types of glasses. There's touch screen, there's keyboards. And so I think increasingly different, more interactive forms of media and delivery of messages, where you can access quality health care, what you should do for your child in terms of care-seeking behavior and training children on appropriate care-seeking behaviors that they can take into adulthood. So I think I'm seeing success with the multimedia kiosks that we're using in community settings of different types.
I just want to piggyback on what Claudia just said. I believe I first saw it in Philadelphia, where the Philadelphia Medical Society decided that when they had patients with diabetes, they would give them a prescription to go to whether it was the church or the library where they had these sort of kiosks that they could learn about their disease. I haven't seen a follow-up to see how well it worked, but the idea of trying to bridge the gap in terms of literacy, help literacy by giving prescriptions to a place where an individual can find out more about his or her disease, I think is a great idea, and a strategy for making sure it works is a different thing. Could I add one more quick thing? The gap between science and policy is something we've been talking about throughout this conference, and it's a very important gap. Communication is probably the most critical issue in that gap, because you can be right on the science. I can tell you from personal experience, you can be right on the science, but the policy that grows out of that is going to be determined by advocacy and how well people are able to do it, and communities need help with that. It's going to be determined by deeply held beliefs, and we've seen a lot of examples of that over the last 8 years. the science may say one thing, but if the deeply held beliefs conflict with that, and you can't communicate within the context of those deeply held beliefs, religious or otherwise, it's not going to work. So the gap between the science and the policy is a critical gap that we, you know, need to try to help to fill the political process. And the point you just made about helping individuals, the groups that have the most money obviously have the most clout with lobbying. So if a group doesn't have a lot of resources, it's very hard to compete in terms of trying to get policies through Congress.
Maybe one way to bridge that gap between science and policy is by focusing the attention of the media on the person with the condition rather than the condition itself. Because if you're going to talk about cancer, and then you're going to only report on the oncogenes, the P53s, you are going to report on the kinases, all these enzymes, people will get amazed. But you know what? You are not making that news relevant to the person who is watching or listening to you. But if you, like we saw in this Unnatural Causes, which is a wonderful series, you focus on the person, the neighborhood, the community, everybody is going to say, my God, look at this plant we have here in the neighborhood. Would that be a problem? Then those citizens, through advocacy, through grassroots movements, they can influence policy. I think that would be one way to do it, focusing on the person rather than on the condition itself.
Let me add in here. It's also focusing on the success of medicine. Too often it's gloom and doom, and it scares folks half to death. And I think that if the media has paid more attention to focusing on stories of success, that you can have diabetes and live longer, you can have cardiovascular disease and do well, I think that would empower people.
I'll speak to how traditional media is trying to struggle with new media. And as you know, every form of traditional media is really scrambling to figure out the new digital world. We at ABC have a separate network for digital. More importantly, we have an internet port where people can go for information, and we try to customize it in some ways. We have a section called On Call where you can go, people who don't want to go to the doctor, and find a subject. And they will have an answer to a list of 450 questions that they can click on. Real doctors or nurses come up on the screen and answer the questions. So that's one little way in which we can try to work our way through this new world. But having said that, I also have to say, speak to a concern which I'm sure we all share, which is the quality of the information on the internet. It's a new highway with a lot of junk on it and a lot of car crashes on the side. And I worry about controlling the content. I know that sounds too socialistic, but I really do worry about that, and we've all got to pay attention to that somehow. And that brings me back to the high level of healthcare reform, which is I don't think any of this is going to happen unless we revive and renew primary care in this country. That's the portal where people have to go to find out what's available and what information they can use, and that's going to take a lot of basic healthcare reform.
But let me ask this question. If you went to David Weston, the president of ABC News, and said, look, I want to do a series on primary care. I want to do 5 stories on World News Tonight. And none of those stories showed any patients. It still was about primary care or prevention. Would you be able to sell that?
No, but we already sold it, and we're going to do a series on primary care, actually.
Well, but Tim, he said none of them show. You can't show primary care without showing.
No, we'll show patients, right, of course.
Okay. Right.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Patients are at the center. That's the whole point of primary care.
And projects that are demonstrative.
Yeah, it gets to Elmer's point that too often a lot of the health reporters get caught up in the esoterica of it.
Yeah. Our system does not favor primary care.
No.
That's not what the money is. That's not what the respect is until we can change that. And medical students are not dumb. It doesn't take them long to realize that people out there in primary care may be doing great work, but they're not getting the kind of reimbursement or the kind of stature or prestige that others are getting. So part of our health reform has to reform the system so that primary care is again valued in this country, and that health care is not just a commodity to be traded in the marketplace to the highest bidder. I mean, I think those are the struggles that we're going through.
I wanted to speak to the need for the intersection between the science and the research and policy piece. I see the media as a way to disseminate the findings of quality research and also to disseminate changes in clinical practice and to the general public, and who then often will take that to their primary care physician or other healthcare provider. The policy research and the recognition, particularly by the center, of the need for policy research to inform future research, but also clinical practice, I think is fantastic that this has finally come. All too often, being a former NIHer, all too often the issue of policy was dismissed, but it's here and it's being respected, and credibility in terms of NIH funding is being put there. So I think that that's fantastic. I think we have a couple of models that show the beauty of the intersection between research or science and policy and the potential for elimination of health disparities. The first is, for example, in the Maryland General Assembly or state legislature, where this is happening actually at state legislatures across the nation. The data are often used, and the results of research findings are used to inform decisions on a piece of legislation. For example, in our state, or mandated health insurance benefits that would have to cover individuals for certain basic procedures or beneficial interventions, for example, cancer screening. And then that is taken by enlightened legislators, and it's passed as legislation. Because of restrictions with ERISA, we found out very soon that that covered only 25% of the insured population, and it certainly didn't cover Medicaid. But we're learning that the state adapted Medicaid benefits and state employee benefits by a regulatory change. So you had science informing legislation, legislation informing regulation. But then we took it a step further with funding from Dr. Ruffin. We asked the general public in the state, did you know that this benefit is covered? And the majority didn't know it. And so policies and regulation in the absence of widespread education to the general public, they just don't work. So you have to take the complete process forward that involves the general public in learning what they are potentially able to access in terms of their benefits plan. Now, the last piece that's a beautiful national model is Women in Government's initiative to eliminate cervical cancer. You have the technology with the development of the human papillomavirus vaccine. You have cervical cancer rates very high in minority and underserved and low-income communities. You have women in state legislatures trying to develop policies that could be enacted through both legislation and regulation, as well as task forces. And then you had a tight grassroots-level educational component to talk about the science behind cervical cancer disparities as well as HPV vaccine. But again, I agree with David, in the absence of taking into consideration cultural norms and religious beliefs, you can't be successful. And we found that in Maryland, we found it in other states in terms of the need to partner with the faith community in an ongoing way, not just around one topic, about the importance of a prevention, a vaccine for a disease that causes significant morbidity and mortality. Because it was the faith community that raised questions about, wait a minute, 9 years old, 11-year old, you're not going to tell the young girls in my church they need to have something that's going to prevent this sexually transmitted disease. So I think that with the programs that foster policy research, there has to be a component that fosters for the general public, not only health literacy, but research literacy, in order to appreciate the influence of research on community health.
Raj, is it common in NIH grants to have a component to that fosters this narrowing of the gap between science and policy, mainly a communications component? I think that they do that, the National Science Foundation, but I don't know about the NIH.
Let's just say that I was at NIH in the 80s and early 90s. There's more than there was then, but there's still too little, given the fact that we have this crisis in access and outcomes. It's far too little. So I think it's a struggle. I think the credibility of the center and some other parts of NIH on the need for policy research, that is a legitimate component of the science translation, is imperative. But certainly not enough funding is put in that.
My first experience with NIH supporting the communication piece was a sickle cell. In 1972, I believe, I became director of the King Drew Sickle Cell Research Center. I served there. Well, that's where I met Claudia. She was, but I met her
college.
Then.
She was this high.
I was in college.
Junior high school.
That was a major. I hope we don't forget that, because the sickle cell movement has done a lot to help us get to where we are now, because many of us came into research. Lou Sullivan, I could do this, Marilyn Gasson. Many of us, our first major research programs were sickle cell disease, because there was such an urgency to get information to communities and to bridge the gap between science and community. So we learned a lot from that, and I think the National Center for Heart Health and Health Disparities, of course, is really pushing that that bridging that gap, as never before.
Dirt.
Hold on. Raj is trying to get in.
Can we just make three? That's okay. I'm between all the MDs, so it's MDs very hard. Just three or four quick points. One of the bridging issues, which I think everybody's talked about it, but I think the communication there will make a very big difference as practitioners. You're saying primary care, but I'm talking about, really, there's so many clinics. If the doctors really get involved between the science, the institutes, and, of course, the policymakers, and I think that is something that needs to happen, and it is happening, but not at a level where it should, because if you think about it, you go to the doctor's office, and if they were really promoting prevention on one side, you're talking about the kiosk and all of that. One of the interesting things I saw, second, was in a Montessori school, a kiosk that was teaching young children about the value of apple and fruits and all the various things. So clearly there are a number of these programs. The third point I want to make to you is that there is so much, as Tim said, information technology, and that is where I come from. Yes, there is a lot of garbage, but there is really also controlled, filtered information. And to be able to set up and allow blogs to be set up that are local blogs by local people, young children to teens and others, we really need to get to healthcare at a lower level in our society rather than us just talking about, Elmer calls the Towers of Babel, remember the conversation we had about that. So the issue is, I think all of you are really very learned and educated, but I think you need to still get back to grassroots. And I'll end with one thing. We have in Rockville, Community Ministry of Rockville, that's 26 group of churches. 6-7 years ago, health was not even a discussion issue. It was a social, it was health services, other services. Today, there's 24 locations where we're providing healthcare services using mobile med. Now, this is something that never happened. So I think that our models, as you all are talking about it, but the key of all of that is still networking. The public-private partnership and creating an umbrella that shows that health disparity to health equity is not just a care or a compassion issue, but an economic issue, and it's fundamentally going to make a difference. When you talk about internationally, terrorism and all the other things are issues of people's poverty, but it also relates to health.
Okay, Elmer.
Yeah, I'm a very practical person. 20 years ago, I started to do radio because I realized that when I was doing medical oncology, that most of the patients that were sent to me for chemotherapy have very advanced conditions. But that was not the point. But the point was that most of those incurable conditions were preventable and early detectable, so I found no point of giving chemotherapy to these kind of patients. So when I was talking to this woman with advanced cervical cancer, she didn't know what a pap smear was, but she knew by heart the soap operas on television. That's when I quit medical oncology. I started to do radio and TV, so I made there to give an advice to NIH. Every night when I drive home at 8:03 p.m., in the local WAMU radio station, there's a wonderful show about the stars, Stardate. What a wonderful show, produced by the observatory in Texas, I don't remember the name, but they tell you every night about how the stars are moving, the planets are aligning, etc. I wonder, where is NIH providing daily information to the American people on health?
Absolutely.
27 institutes. All this wealth of information is stored there. Why don't they have the imagination to put it out on a daily basis for people? Why is that these people from the observatory are doing it and educating Americans about the stars? So I think what we need to do is make sure that NIH really communicates with the public on a daily basis, on everything, and using all media, traditional and new media. I bet in 5 years, the American public are going to be much more aware of many, many, many things that are going to empower them.
See, another thing that would do is to increase trust.
Exactly.
The main goal. And unless you address trust, none of this is going to happen, despite policies, despite education. Patients and people really need to feel that the information they're getting from their doctors and loved ones is one of trust.
XM Radio now, for example, that they merged with Sirius, they have a channel that's called Doctor Radio. Wonderful opportunity for NIH to be there on a daily basis promoting health. It's like in my radio show, I have 2 hours every day now nationwide. They ask me, for example, Dr. Huerta, my father is going to start dialysis, kidney dialysis. I say, how old is your father? Well, he's 62. He's young for that. What condition brought him to this dialysis? Well, high blood pressure. Okay, tell me, did your father take care of the blood pressure? No, doctor, you know how men are. Okay. That's a wonderful window of opportunity to talk about the preventative nature of kidney conditions. So I think NIH, they should use all this media and put money behind it. And now, the National Cancer Institute, for example, and this is a shame, they are cutting the funds for outreach program for people. And this is something that needs to be discussed and needs to be changed, and the community wouldn't permit these kind of things.
George, I just want to... I think that's exactly right. What we've talked about, though, is the use of media to talk to specific target audiences, and I think that's very important. So I think implicitly we're talking about disparity populations, but I think we also need to communicate to the general public about health inequality generally, because there's such low levels of awareness. Even when folks are aware of health inequality, there are a whole bunch of myths that surround health inequality about bad genes, bad behavior. I think there's a real responsibility for the media to highlight, in the context of general reporting, the fact that we have gross inequality in health access to health care and health care quality. In the example of the reporting on primary care, which I'm very excited to hear about, because primary care is an issue that must be squarely on the agenda and in the general discourse around health reform, we ought to be talking about not only the fact that our primary care system is very threatened, but primary care is also maldistributed, so that the very communities that have the highest health care needs have the least access to a primary care infrastructure, and that infrastructure that exists is often of lower quality. More importantly, we need to say that this affects all of us. It's not just a problem for those disparity populations over there. We need to be talking to general audiences about the crisis of our health infrastructure and how inequality in that infrastructure affects all of us.
And I'll just piggyback by saying that is one of the items we've got on our working list for primary care. So let me introduce just another little element here. As everybody knows here, we're on our way to bankrupting this country with health care because we're spending 9 to 10% inflation rate versus the general inflation rate, $2.6 trillion this year. one of the reasons we're spending so much money is that, in fact, we are communicating with the public very effectively about all the new drugs and technology. And so we have a population.
Pardon me? We're selling.
Yes, oh, we're selling. The direct to consumer advertising we all know about. So Americans have come to the point where we think the latest is automatically the best. And we want to get that new drug or that new test or that new technology we heard about on the radio, on television. We're all part of this. So I'm all for more communication, obviously, but I want to make sure we're communicating at the level of honesty and what works and what doesn't work. And that's why I keep coming back to primary care in all of its faces, obviously nurse practitioners, physician assistants, medical homes, etc. That's where I think people need to get most of their information.
Tim, since you're right, folks need to get most of their information from those sources, but still folks turn to you and turn to Elmer and turn to the major media for a lot of their, if not most of their, healthcare information. And, I mean, again, to keep it real, as the young folks would say, isn't it difficult to sell a story in the major media that is not about what is new? Isn't it more difficult to sell sort of the social determinants of health than the new breakthrough?
Absolutely, and that's one of the challenges I've taken on personally at the one place I have some control, at ABC. That's part of what I'm speaking to the staff about, both in New York and Washington. And it's a tough uphill battle. I personally refuse to do so-called cutting-edge stories anymore, but I'm in a position where I can pick and choose what I want to do. It is a constant uphill battle, but slowly the message is getting across. All I think we can hope for, George, is in addition to that stuff, we're going to do the other stuff.
But is there a role for folks around this table, folks in this audience, at a national level, at a local level? Is there a role for them to recognize that there are some gaps here around communications and bring together some of these communication people, some of the issues, and talk about it? Is there a role here, David? I mean, may be a role, but is it possible?
Well, I think it is. Let me say first, though, that I really think that when it comes to our schools should be in a position to educate our children about health and about what it takes to become healthy. Now, obviously, we put a lot of focus on the obesity problem, and that's created a situation where we're seeing more. But I think it was Dave Rogers who first had the idea about, it's 36 years, 35 years ago, about school health clinics. But I think within the curricula of schools, students ought to learn about health and healthy lifestyles. They ought to also experience it at school, because just as children can be addicted, and they are every day, they become addicted to salt, sweets, and fats. I'm convinced that they can be addicted to regular physical activity and good nutrition. And parents have shown that. There are parents in this country who, in fact, have shown that when they insist in their home that their children have healthy diets, that they grow up. My children are more rigid than I am about, you know, eating. I go to the house sometimes and I wonder, why are we eating all these fruits and vegetables? But I mean, I believe that children can be addicted, I hate to use that word, but I mean habituated to healthy lifestyles. I believe the schools have a major role to play in that. I believe communities have a major role to play in that. But we, you know, we're not funding that. We don't even fund physical education, let alone good nutrition in the schools. So we are addicting our children to unhealthy behaviors and unhealthy lifestyles.
And it actually gets worse, Dr. Thatcher, after a child grows up. It's so hard to change their behavior. If you start when they're 7, 8 years of age and talk about what's healthy, it's going to be so much easier for them to be more compliant and adherent to healthy lifestyle down the road. And it's a major problem, I agree with you fully.
And a part of the healthy lifestyle that should start in the school systems in terms of education of our children should include proper health-seeking behaviors. That is, you're a child, and when you become a grown-up, you should have that annual health maintenance visit. And you should focus throughout the lifespan on prevention and wellness.
Sure.
I think that that's essential.
Sure. Let me interject one other thing. We actually went to a school at Indiana, Imagine School. Had about 1,200 kids, and we were there to bring them good quality school books. We found out that most of the kids were had no idea what a vegetable was, didn't know what broccoli looked like. And this is in Indiana, so yeah, it's we decided that perhaps versus school books that we needed to do wellness material instead.
I think we can also do things like video games and others that really promote the same thing.
Yes.
That's what I meant to say earlier. The media can partner with the schools.
Right.
There's a lot that the media can do to help schools put forth that kind of
thing. Yeah, I think we have a lot of learn from the business community.
Yeah.
24 hours after this episode of the shoe throwing to the president, there were video games all over the internet. 24 hours selling these things. So that's the kind of thing we need to be very agile in our outreach and changing all the time. But maybe a practical advice for our audience this afternoon, this morning, is that I'm pretty sure many of our members in the audience, they are often consulted by the media on interviews or things like that. There is always a moment to talk about prevention. Even if they are talking about some very specific biological condition or issue, there is always a little window for prevention. When I work with CNN in Espanol, I do the medical editing for them, so they call me when something happens. So Fidel Castro is getting, for example, a problem in the colon. Dr. Huerta, what will we go in here? Say, okay, but listen, colorectal cancer is preventable, whatever. I have always my little window of pushing prevention, healthy lifestyles, etc. So I think the public can do every time there's a window of opportunity to do that.
So if there's a window of opportunity always to talk about prevention, maybe there's a window of opportunity in giving grants for more emphasis on communication and narrowing that gap between science and policy.
Go ahead. I just want to. There are two issues we haven't talked about. I'd like you to think about the future of media and policy in terms of the baby boomers are moving to elder care, and that's going to be a very substantial health disparity issue. And I'd like to hear from Dr. Satcher about that, and Claudia and others. And the second is the returning soldiers. I think we have a very serious issue coming up in terms of how are we going to take care of disparity issues that deals with that, because this has been a different war.
Let me just comment on the last point, because, as you know, one of the things I had an opportunity to do was to release the first ever Surgeon General's report on mental health, which is still gets far too little attention, because when you look at WHO data, mental disorders are second only to cardiovascular disease, and cancer is right up there with it in terms of causes of disability adjusted life years.
That's
mental disorders, depression. It is very hard to control diabetes in a patient who is depressed if you don't diagnose and treat the depression. And that happens every day. But we have been involved with both with post-Katrina population and soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. And we are seeing more post-traumatic stress disorder than we have seen from any former engagement because of the nature of that war, because there's no clear front line, if you will. And also we're seeing more people returning with mild or post-traumatic brain disorder and the impact that that has on an individual and family. All the families that have been destroyed because of people coming back who can't relate to their spouses and their families anymore. We had a conference here on May 21st here in Washington, and the title was Wounded Troops and Partners, the Unmet Needs of Soldiers Returning. So this is an area that needs a lot of attention. We need to look at how we can, number one, better prepare people if we're going to fight these crazy wars. Then people ought to be prepared to be more resilient, and hopefully we're not going to continue to do that. But people come back with problems that we have not been prepared for. More people are surviving injuries than ever before, but what does it mean to survive and come back here and be unable to function normally? And nobody seems to be that concerned about it. So it's a major problem, and we could talk about that all morning. As I said, we had an all-day conference on it. We had to turn people away because there was so much interest in talking about post-traumatic stress disorder as reflected in post-Iraq soldiers and their families.
But I think it gets into the clinical research, it gets into all of the areas of what we're going to do, because that population is really going to need a lot of help, and it's going to grow, and it is going to create a longer and bigger disparity issue.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head. The returning soldiers are becoming a new disparity population. And there's some work in progress, a signed agreement between the VA Secretary, HRSA, and HHS. And some of you all are involved in the AHEC program, or Area Health Education Centers program, that is providing existing web-based and other training programs available through the VA to community mental health caregivers. And originally the focus was largely on health professionals, mental health professionals, but in community settings that see these returning soldiers with traumatic brain injury and PTSD. And we've added caregivers also, the social support and skill building that the caregivers, the loved one, will have to have. So that's a existing initiative. Please contact the AHEC program at HRSA or the VA for that TBI PTSD program. But I wanted to respond to your health communication grants, and if something like that should evolve, that it would include non-traditional ways of communication, but also with an emphasis on building public trust in the importance of science and research in the community. And the term we use is research literacy. I think it is a myth that communities most hit hard by disparities, one, are not interested in their health. That's absolutely not true, and are not interested in research. The problem is the communication of the researcher of these complex concepts to the general public is what has to be improved. When a group of individuals, for example, we have a successful mini medical school program in Baltimore City and then rural parts of the state, when information is communicated in a way that the general public can understand complex results from research studies, it's like a light bulb goes off. And then you have the general public asking for human subjects protection training and HIPAA training. And then people started wanting to adopt and hold research, and they also want to make it accountable. That is, no more helicopter research, no in and out taking samples and not giving something back to the community or the results, but going beyond simply CBPR, which is, I adhere to those principles in many of my studies, but going beyond and having the community participate in the funding of these projects. That is, the grant money goes to the community. That's both something to build trust. It's a respectful gesture that I value your contributions as a leader at a grassroots level. And it's also an economic investment in small community-based organizations who need funding just to pay their lease and pay their employees.
Build on what Dr. Buchanan said. I think you're absolutely right that community-based participatory research has the promise of addressing all of these issues, trust, having communities be part of the research effort, and to have research be accountable to the communities that they're serving. But I think it goes further. When we talk to communities about what they're concerned about, when we understand what their issues are, they include things that are at the community level. The fact that folks disproportionately have toxic waste dumps, have problems with air pollution, traffic, inadequate housing, being physically separated from areas of job growth. I think communities understand that these are all issues that relate back to health, and they want to put these on our research agenda. I think there's some important CBPR models that do that and help us to importantly focus upstream where we're going to make the biggest difference in prevention.
But in CBPR, funding needs to be shared with the community that is participating, not just having the community on an advisory committee. They should be getting funding to do parts of the implementation of
In that regard, in that regard, and maybe another practical advice for our audience here in terms of engaging the media, the local media, wherever they live, is don't be afraid of contacting the local radio station, the local newspaper, the local television station, and you will be surprised that these editors, they will really be very receptive to your ideas. And a practical advice that happened to me, if they open the door to you, don't let that door shut. But be there every time they ask you to collaborate with them. Little by little, you will create that wonderful relationship between the scientists or the community people and the media, and they will always use you, and you will have a window of opportunity to put your message out.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment on the community-based research. When, I guess 2000, when Help the People 2010 was released, the program in government that was, I think, best geared toward that was REACH, Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health. And in many ways, some of our greatest successes have come from that program, and the major criteria was the grantee had to be the community. And then the community could contract with academia or with the health department, but the grantee had to be the community. And that was a CDC-based program, Wayne Giles, the PI. But NCMHD has recently funded, because CDC lost a lot of funding, so Dr. Ruffin looked at that program and has been supporting the REACH program because of the fact that communities are so involved. I don't know if there, I'm sure there are some REACH people here, but from our perspective, it's been a great example of just what you're talking about.
You know, as we come to a close and begin to focus more on frankly advising the new administration on healthcare reform, I want to talk a bit about something that that I think David brought up earlier, and that's deeply held beliefs. And there's a lot of optimism in this panel and in this room and maybe even in the country that we're going to have healthcare reform and that we're going to focus on prevention and we're going to focus on primary care and all the rest. Well, I'm old enough to remember that we went through this before with Clinton 1. And we all said then, well, the stars are aligning and all the rest and we're going to get there. But there were some deeply held beliefs by a number of folks and a number of groups that stopped it. I mean, there were some other reasons as well. So, and David also raised, if you were a young researcher now, if you were a young researcher 8 years ago and you wanted to go into health disparities, you're 35 years old and say, you know, I'd like to have a nice life, I'd like to live in Rockville, I'd like to do this, but I don't know that health disparities research and this kind of focus is a way to tenure. Whether it's at the NIH or if it's in academia. So there are a number of these challenges that I'd like to discuss as our time comes to a close so that we can better strategize how we go forward if indeed the stars are aligned.
George.
Go ahead, man. I'll go.
The role for private sector comes in very important here. You know, Tim talked about $26 trillion right now. If you look at 2020, we're talking about $4 trillion. The health disparity is really one of the largest problems, and I think if you think about it, whether it's pharmaceutical companies or others, and the private sector needs to recognize that this is going to be a huge economic impact. So more than just the government, I think if we get the private sector very activated, you will realize that health disparity is becoming an economic issue to them rather than just a social and healthcare issue. And I think that is something that media has to play a role, and the policymaker have to play a role.
Yeah, I agree with that fully. I was just thinking on the day I looked at TV, and there was the first face transplant from the Cleveland Clinic. Yet this has not shown what we're doing here. The media has chosen not to do this, but to look at that and to sensationalize that part of medicine, I think, is a problem.
No, I agree. I wanted to follow up on George's point about I guess the word would be reward. Do people get rewarded for doing research dealing with the health disparities? I think one of the most important things that the National Center for Minority Health and Health Disparities has done is to draw young people into this field, even forgiving, as a way of repaying loans. It's a great strategy. The question for the future is the one that we face in academia. And that is, are we going to reward this research? So, you know, we've gone through that. If we encourage people to go into an area, is academia going to reward that, you know, with promotions and tenure? Is NIH going to reward that when it intramural research dealing with health disparities? Is it going to get the same kind of credibility and rewards as other research? It's going to be a critical issue in the future. People, especially students and young faculty members, it doesn't take them long to figure out what's important and what's being rewarded. If it's not being rewarded in terms of grants and tenure and promotion, it's not going to last long.
Yeah, stupid.
Right. If I could piggyback on that, I'll say what I said at the outset. I believe there's no more important, no more pressing scientific question than how do we address inequality in health. And so I think to the extent that NIH can communicate that, and there's still some work to be done in terms of getting all of the ICs on board, having disparities as a core part of that research agenda, then I think that we have a lever to help shape the rewards and incentives in academia. I think of how powerfully NIH sets the agenda for and sets the context for how academic research is conducted. I think to the extent that we communicate the importance of addressing this issue, I think hopefully we'll begin to see some change.
I just have to comment on the facial story. I couldn't agree more, and I was called early in the morning to be on Good Morning America to talk about it. I said, nope, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to write a memo about healthcare policy instead. Yeah. And I did, literally, at that moment, send it out to our people. I'm not pretending I'm a saint. I've participated in those kinds of things in the past. But I am really feeling that we are entering a time when some of these issues are going to get traction with the public because there is such a generalized anxiety now about the economy, which quickly translates into job insecurity and loss of health care. And the other things I mentioned, I think, are happening. And even the as you talk about the Battle of the 90s, which we both shared, there were a lot of organizations then, pharma, insurance, to name two obvious ones, who continued for a long time to suffer from a disease I call mural dyslexia, the inability to read the handwriting on the wall. And I think they're seeing the handwriting on the wall because they are, as far as we can tell, actively participating now in the discussions. They're not trying to fight them. They will at some point try to stake out their turf, but things are happening that weren't happening in the early 90s. I just have to say that.
Maybe it's that we're getting to a point where a lot of these discussions, whether it's health care reform or discussions about health disparities, it's been us versus them. And maybe because of the way the economy is going, there's more of us and fewer of them.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's that is a star that is coming to line. Yes, Anna.
Maybe just they say that all politics is local. Same way, I think we can say that all health education is local too. So in addition to wonderful things like Tim is doing nationwide, I think we all have an opportunity to do some local activities, and that's going to really change the conditions at the local level. That's very important. That's what I said before. I think all of us sitting in this room, we have the obligation to really reach out to our local media people and do some local contributions.
I'm very optimistic about the opportunities for young people that want to pursue a career in health disparities research. And I also want to give my shout out for the loan repayment program. Man, it would have been great if they had that when I went through medical school, but it's a phenomenal program. And it's one of the incentives that would allow young people, PhD or clinical, to pay back some of that debt so they could focus intensely on their career development as a researcher. The other piece for the physician incentives, and we've been talking about primary care too, is the need to restructure the incentives or the rewards in terms of physician reimbursement, specialty versus primary care. Because as you said, I'm at a medical school, the medical students who have a lot of debt see the handwriting on the wall. And okay, if I've got to pay all this debt off, I'm not going to pick primary care. So we really have to look at restructuring how we reimburse and how we reward primary care and prevention and wellness.
And also, as you all have alluded to, and also thinking about What is a study of health? What is a study of health care? Is it just a PhD in the sciences? Is it just an MD? Is it just a master's degree in public health? I mean, could it be a PhD in sociology? Could it be, and I mean, those kinds of things, and being able to reward
yes,
all
yes,
of that
and
fund all of that.
Right. Yes, and in nursing, and in social work, and in pharmacy, yes.
Sure.
Health educators.
I think that's one of the major messages of this conference, and certainly a major message of Social Determinants of Health Report, is that we have to integrate these disciplines. We have to have transdisciplinary research going if we're going to solve these problems. I think one of the traps we fall into sometimes, though, is the dichotomy thing. So you hear people saying, it's not about health care, it's about social determinants, or it's not about personal responsibility, it's about all of them. And, you know, if this hotel reports that during this conference there's been no increase in the use of its pool, its walking trail along the river, there's something going wrong here. If we're not any more physically active and the people are not in health, if our diets are no different, then we're sending the wrong message.
Yeah,
so I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah.
So it's not just social determinants, it's what we do when we have these opportunities.
I think the motto of NIH is health for the people. I would say health education for the people should be the one.
You know, we have a remarkable opportunity now to educate some folks who are about to come into office, and we've had a lot of discussion from the podium, whether it's the podium here or the podium in some of the breakout sessions. But what we've always wanted to do, and what Dr. Ruffin, his vision for this conference is to really engage everyone who is here, not just the folks who deliver messages and the folks who receive them, but also to hear from everyone. And we're going to take that opportunity now to affect a very specific policy agenda. And that policy agenda is healthcare reform. But just before I engage everyone here and get your ideas on healthcare reform, I'd like to thank this panel for being here and for being so wonderful and expert.
Thank you.